You're listening to The Skeptic's Guide to the Universe, your escape to reality.
Hello and welcome to The Skeptic's Guide to the Universe. Today is Monday, November 15th, 2010, and this is your host, Stephen Novella. Joining me this week are Bob Novella.
Hey, everybody.
Rebecca Watson.
Hello, everyone.
Jay Novella.
Hey, guys.
And Evan Bernstein.
Hi, everybody.
Hello.
Hey, Steve, is this podcast going to air on Friday evening or Saturday morning?
No.
Very good.
It'll probably be Friday morning, actually.
The reason I ask is because Friday will be the 19th of November.
Yes.
Correct me if I'm wrong.
It'll
be
Friday.
Oh, the 19th.
Do you know what the 19th of November is?
Yes.
No. It's a Harry Potter opening.
Wait, remember the 19th of November, right?
No. World Toilet Day.
Yes.
What?
That's beautiful.
Evan, you're fired.
Dedicated.
Really?
You're not doing the day of the week anymore.
So, to promote sanitary conditions all around the world and improving toilet conditions.
World right. Toilet Day. That's what you
world
went
toilet
with.
Day.
So does any,
it's founded in 2001.
Does anyone legitimately go, oh, today's World Toilet Day. I think I'll go scrub my toilet. No.
It's not so much that. It's an appreciation for the fine waste facilities that we have in our country and others, and to promote better waste management systems in developing countries.
And to recognize the contributions of Thomas Crapper.
Mm-hmm. That is his name,
yes.
Right?
That's the guy, name
that
of the guy who
yeah.
invented the flush toilet.
Yeah. Oh, my God.
And the person who invented toilet paper was Johnny Wiper.
It's actually called the siphonic flush toilet.
Really? Fascinating.
I've learned so much today about toilets.
This is good shit, guys.
God. I'm shocked that we didn't win that Fizzorg Best yeah. Science Podcast Award.
We did?
Jeez.
Is it over?
We did it?
Yeah, we didn't win.
I'm shocked.
Science Weekly won.
Shocked.
Oh, that's an okay show.
I guess our listeners didn't love us enough.
Well, maybe they were sick of all the shit.
Bastards.
Look, maybe if it was World Toilet Day earlier, we might have had a chance.
That's true. Well, we flushed that chance down the drain.
Oh, man.
We pissed it away.
All right, Bob.
Oh, boy.
Bob, tell us about the magic giant bubbles at the center of our galaxy. They might not be magic.
Magic?
How am I gonna top the talk we just had? This is going to be really hard. Okay, but yeah, this was pretty cool. I love when this happens. You know, there's not that many, it seems to me, mature sciences where something so close, relatively speaking, yet so mysterious and awe-inspiring can be found. And plus, this is 50,000 light years across, this thing that they found. Basically, what happened was astrophysicists with the Hartford Smithsonian Center for Astrophysics in Cambridge, Mass., looking at public NASA data, which is interesting in and of itself. That, I mean, this is just data that was publicly available. They reported recently that there are two previously unseen bubbles above and below the plane of the Milky Way. Each one about 25,000 light years across, which is about, 186,000, carry the two, 147 quadrillion miles. I mean, these things are just gargantuan. If you could see them with the naked eye, which you can't, but if you could, they would stretch across half the night sky. So and they're above the core of the galaxy, so they're really far away. So these things are just amazingly huge. Doug Finkbeiner, it's his real name, of the Harvard Smithsonian Center for Astrophysics, and he's also the study leader, he said, we don't fully understand that their nature or origin. They're emitting about the same amount of energy as 100,000 exploding stars or supernovae. The two bubbles are dramatic, enigmatic, and huge. End quote. Now, how could you not love something that's dramatic, enigmatic, and huge all at the same time? So they saw these bubbles using NASA's Fermi Gamma Ray Space Telescope, which maps the sky's gamma ray light, gamma rays, of course, being the most energetic form of light. And it's worth mentioning that the space telescope is named after Enrico Fermi, who was a physicist who won the Nobel Prize for his work on inducing radioactivity. He worked with Oppenheimer. He also helped develop the first nuclear reactor and contributed to quantum and nuclear physics, and is one of the scientific giants of the 20th century. And after all, you usually don't get a space telescope named after you if you're just a piker. So why were they even looking for gamma radiation like this? Well, they were looking for dark matter initially, which was kind of a surprise. But it kind of makes sense, though, that dark matter kind of reveals itself gravitationally, right? So, I mean, that's really the only way that we can detect it. so far. So then the core of the galaxy would be a great place to find it, right? I mean, you've got the dense core of a galaxy, lots of matter concentrated into a very small space. So yeah, so I think it makes sense that it's a good place to look for dark matter signatures.
Sure.
So now gamma rays are relevant because the models that they're using were telling them that when dark matter and I guess anti-dark matter particles, which I'm not too...
Whoa.
I haven't read too much about that. I hadn't either, but they're saying that when dark matter and anti-dark matter collide, when they annihilate each other, gamma rays would result. So they're looking kind of towards the core for this gamma ray signature. But when they finally isolated the proper gamma rays, though, the boundaries of this bubble were found that were sharp and precisely defined. Now, there was this fog of gamma rays, you know, suffusing the entire core of the galaxy. So they kind of had to subtract that stuff out. And these are gamma rays that are produced by, say, very fast moving electrons, like very close to the speed of light. When they hit just a normal photon of light, the resulting collision produces a gamma ray. And so you've got this fog of gamma rays all that they had to subtract out, which was kind of difficult. And they were left with these two bubbles with very sharply defined edges. Now, if dark matter was the culprit, the edges wouldn't have been fuzzy, presumably, because it would have been, you know, after a very long time, these sharp edges would kind of just get, they would just wouldn't be as defined as they are. So the sharp edges are likely caused by a large and rapid release of energy that happened relatively recently. So that kind of ruled out the dark matter. So then what could have caused this? That's the next question. All right, if this isn't dark matter, well, kind of. One of the contenders are black holes. And now you know how charged particles can orbit around a black hole, the accretion disk, and they kind of these charged particles can be spit out of the poles to create those beautiful jets. You've probably seen images of a galaxy spewing these jets at right angles to the core.
Don't get caught in that jet, by the way.
Yeah, right. Tell me about it. But
so where's that energy coming from?
It's coming from the accretion disk is the matter that's swirling faster and faster and faster towards the black hole, and this matter gets incredibly hot. It's interacting. It's very dense, very hot, and somehow I guess it's related to the magnetic field of the black hole. These things are just spit out the poles up and down and travel for God, hundreds, for tens of thousands of light years or more. And it's actually one of the most common ways that matter and energy are distributed throughout the universe is through these jets. So they think what might have happened was maybe a million years ago, I don't know, the monster black hole in our galaxy probably, I don't know, it swallowed something big. Something happened. It was a big event. It could have taken a long time to happen, but it was incredibly energetic. And they think that this possibly could be like the echo of those jets from a million years ago. These expanding bubbles that are emitting gamma rays somehow is the byproduct of those jets from a million years ago or so. And potentially this is happening over, lots of galaxies. It's just that it's so faint and so hard to detect that we just haven't been able to detect them elsewhere except, the galaxy that we're in. Now, the other possible explanation they're looking at is kind of like a combination of lots of stars, lots of hot young stars being born at the same time and near the core of the galaxy, creating their own stellar wind. Plus, you add to that all these supernovae exploding, and you kind of add all that together, and they think that could possibly have created this effect. I'm kind of leaning towards the black hole explanation. It just makes sense that you've got these polar jets exiting a black hole, creating these bubbles. It just doesn't sound right to me that the stellar wind and supernovae could create these symmetrical balls of expanding gas on the above and below the plane of our galaxy. It just seems, I don't know, in my opinion, it just seems like black holes are maybe the more likely culprit. If not that, then my other vote goes for alien galactic engineering.
I go with black holes.
Whenever you have a really energetic event, a supermassive black hole is a good bet, right? I
mean, oh, yeah.
Yeah, what are the other possibilities?
I just told you.
Well,
weren't you listening?
So, Bob, did you get a sense of how confident they are that in this observation? And do we really have to wait for some independent replication before we can take these things for granted?
No, the structures are clearly there. There were hints of these structures years ago in other surveys, but the instruments just were not sensitive enough. So, yeah, there is a structure there. It's nicely delineated. These bubble shapes are definitely there. The only real question now is how the hell did they get there? So, yeah, that's pretty, you know, I don't think there's too much doubt. Of course, they'll replicate it, and our instruments will get even more precise. But the Fermi Space Telescope is the highest resolution gamma ray survey out there, and it's just getting more and more detailed because it takes these surveys like every 3 hours. So it's getting more and more and more detailed. So, I don't think there's any question about it, really.
Now, Bob, regarding the origin of these bubbles, is it your belief that the astronomers were genuinely baffled?
Oh, I saw articles with baffled in the title, so yes, they were.
There you go. All right. What more do you need? Rebecca, tell us about exploiting psychic, quote-unquote psychic kids.
I would love to. Yes, the American TV channel A&E, which used to stand for Arts and Entertainment, but I'm not sure which of those this falls under, they have just premiered their second season of the show Psychic Kids, Children of the Paranormal, which is led by, quote-unquote, medium Chip Coffey, who does claim to have psychic powers. And the show is basically about finding children who are 12 to 18 who say they have things like visions and demonic possessions, other sort of paranormal-ish feelings like that. And it tells these kids that they are, in fact, psychic. And then they teach the kids how to hone their psychic powers. And this is for a weekly, hour-long TV show. Which I feel is kind of horrendous. I'm kind of struggling. I'm at a loss for the right adjective to describe
abusive.
A show. Abusive, I think, is good. Yeah, that's
it's exploitation.
A good word for it. It's disgusting, really, because you've got these kids who could have severe issues. You know, they could have quite severe psychological issues. They might be having, you know, seizures and things like that they're passing off as paranormal. I mean, they could have real problems. And these people, these adults, are basically telling them that they're special and psychic, and instead of getting them, you know, real psychological help, they're parading them in front of, you know, millions of viewers for fun and profit. So on Skeptic, my fellow Skeptic writer, Jen, posted about the show and how horrific it was. And the wonderful Skeptic readers were so incensed that this exists that they've started a campaign to get it off the air. Because it's irresponsible and horrible. So you out there in SGU land can, in fact, help. If you go to the link that's going to be in the show notes, you'll see that there's a letter-writing campaign. You can go to a website, aetv.com. They have a feedback form. You can send them an email. You can call them. And you can send them snail mail, which is especially appreciated because they tend to pay attention more to those, because anybody can send an email, but very few people will go to the trouble to actually purchase a stamp. And with any luck, we can make this season of Psychic Kids the last. Although presumably they've seen this coming and have already taken measures to prevent their cancellation, right. But we'll see.
Yeah, you know, we're not just whining about another psychic show. I really do think that this is exploitative and potentially harmful. The worst
thing
when
you could children do for, involved.
Yeah, yeah, and the worst thing you could do to somebody is play into their delusions. You know what I mean? Or you could take what might be a harmless phase or sort of fantasy life that some kids are using to cope with, you know, the craziness of being an adolescent. And yeah, let's lock that down and solidify that by completely investing them in this notion that they're psychic. That, you know, maybe they don't have trouble, you know, socializing with their peers. They're just, you know, a weird paranormal creature. That's a good healthy attitude to give them.
Yeah. It's similar to you know, exorcisms, I think, when,
yeah.
You know, people have serious problems, instead of having them looked at scientifically and actually helping them, you just pass it off as the supernatural and, you know, you just do more harm than good.
Oh, absolutely. I mean, I've seen that happen. You know, a parent with a troubled child, it's a lot easier to think, oh, maybe I should rethink my parenting style, or, you know, maybe I need to invest more in addressing some of these issues. No, the trouble is this kid's possessed by a demon. Let me get them exorcised, and that will solve all of our problems. It's clearly yeah. nothing to do with me or the child. It's something from the outside.
Yeah.
Right. Quite depressing.
Very unhealthy. One more news item before we go on to Who's That Noisy. There was a article published in the rheumatology journal, the journal Rheumatology, in fact, where the study looked at the use of homeopathic remedies for chronic arthritis. And essentially, it was designed to compare two factors, whether or not people who were treated by who underwent a homeopathic consultation, basically, and whether or not they got better, and if so, did the perceived improvement in symptoms of arthritis come from the homeopathic remedy itself, or from the consultation, the process of going through the consultation? And what the study showed, the bottom line is that there was absolutely no benefit added from the remedy itself. So the homeopathic remedy was no different than placebo. Homeopathy doesn't work. Surprise, surprise.
Again.
Right. But what is very disturbing is the fact that the authors are promoting this article, this study, as showing that homeopathy works, not that homeopathy doesn't work. And what they're arguing is that the homeopathic consultation works, that there's something special and specific to the interaction between the homeopath and the patient that has a positive, you know, therapeutic effect, so which is absurd. And it's also not what the study was designed to show.
Kind of like what, a human placebo effect kind of thing going on, like between human interaction?
But that's well known. Right, it's well known that there are non-specific therapeutic effects. Right, there are non-specific perceived subjective benefits, and even some concrete ones to getting attention from a professional, from a therapist, from a caregiver. So that's already well established. Right, being people who are getting attention, and you know, someone's asking them about their symptoms and about what they're doing to take care of themselves, they're going to take better care of themselves as a result of that. Just the touchy-feely, you know, I'm getting attention from somebody who cares about what I'm going through, makes people feel better. We're social creatures. You know, those kind of things have an actual positive impact on our emotion, on our mood. And pain is a very subjective experience that responds significantly to things like mood and emotion. So these are all well-established concepts. So it's of no surprise that spending time with a practitioner, whatever crazy nonsense, you know, is at the basis of the interaction, it's going to have a positive subjective effect. What's deceptive to the point of being, you know, just almost fraud is trying to claim that in some way supports homeopathy specifically. Because, again, the study wasn't even designed to control for any variable that would enable you to say that there's anything specific to the homeopathic consultation that's of value. All of the measured benefit could be due to the known non-specific effects of just attention. So this is really – this is something that the, you know, the homeopathic proponents, as well as just, you know, complementary alternative medicine proponents are doing in general, is trying to take non-specific effects – and then present them and interpret them as if they were specific benefits or specific effects of a specific intervention. That theme keeps coming back over and over again. And it is it's deceptive. It's nonsense. It's not the conventional wisdom that, you know, we accept in the rest of medicine. It's all just a desperate attempt to take essentially negative studies and to spin it.
The sad thing is it's probably going to be successful.
Yeah.
I mean, this has already been, you know, all over the alternative health, you know, blogosphere or whatever. And, you know, it takes us so long, unfortunately, to get around to debunking this stuff, in terms of how fast the lie can spread, you know. It's kind of depressing.
Well, isn't it funny, though? You know, they're saying that the remedies don't work, and they're spinning it into something that's good.
Yeah, right? It's impressive, really.
Right? That's quite amazing that they could do that.
Or insane, yes.
Here's right out of the press release.
Damn.
Homeopathic consultations differ from those in conventional medicine in that homeopaths focus on treating the patient, whereas conventional doctors tend to treat the illness. That's the whole holistic nonsense. Yeah. It's just not true. I mean, it's you know, part and parcel of good medicine and of medical training to treat people as people. I mean, you basically have to do that. Now, that doesn't mean that every single practitioner always spends as much time as they should with a patient and they're not rushed. And if you have a busy practice, you know, especially with reimbursement the way it is these days, you literally will lose money. The amount that you get reimbursed just from sitting and talking to patients doesn't even cover your overhead often.
Do you think that with studies like that, though, maybe we can start to change that once you see that sitting down with a patient and talking to them more reduces their overall healthcare costs than it could be?
Well, there's a few things worth pointing out here. First of all, this study didn't show that it was cost-effective. Most of the improvement was fairly subjective. The improvement was not blinded. It was not very impressive. You know, the primary outcome measures were actually no different. It was only the secondary outcome measures that were different. So it's not necessarily a huge effect, and it could be partly artifact as well. We don't know how much is just patients reporting that they feel better because they are interacting with a practitioner who appears to be invested in them and their symptoms. Also, it's worth noting that there was a previous study comparing the size, the magnitude of the placebo effect from a homeopathic consultation versus a conventional medicine consultation, and they found no difference. So the claim of the authors of this study that homeopathic consultations have a greater therapeutic effect is not based on evidence and is in fact contradicted by other studies and was not even studied in this experiment. They didn't compare homeopathic consultation to conventional consultation. They compared it to no consultation, and again, in an unblinded fashion. So as far as that's concerned, this study is really worthless. The only thing this study actually tells us is that homeopathic remedies are no different than placebo. But regarding your specific point, Rebecca, I do think that we may need to and a lot of people think this, that we may need to shift reimbursement away from, you know, procedure-based interventions and provide greater reimbursement for, you know, practitioner time talking to patients, because that does have value and it may be undervalued in the system. But also keep in mind, most homeopaths are paid cash on the barrel, right? You know, if you want to go into a doctor's office, you're going to pay them cash up front. No insurance companies. They'll spend as much time as you want with them. In fact, there are practices that are called boutique practices where that's the case. If you pay a physician the way you pay an alternative practitioner, they'll spend as much time with you as you want too.
Wow.
It's totally on the basis of how things get reimbursed. There's nothing specific about the homeopathic consultation. It's nonsense. And in fact, if you actually are familiar with the details of the consultation, it is literal nonsense. The kind of questions they're asking you are nonsensical. They're not based upon anything real. It's based upon their magical thinking nonsense. Do you cry when you hear music? You know, stuff like that.
What are your feelings on dragons?
Yeah, it's an astrological reading. It is no different than an astrological reading, this sort of personality profiles they do that are supposed to affect your therapy. But yeah, Bob, you're right. It's just unbelievable that they're getting away with this nonsense.
I'd love to see Steve do a controlled experiment just on his own and do half these patients, I'm just going to say utter nonsense to them for half an hour. Mm-hmm. You know, I'd like that videotaped, you know, and also I'd like to see the results. I'd like to see just saying nonsense, like just asking nonsense questions.
I will say, Rebecca, so if you control as a variable the kind of interaction you have with a patient. And this study has been done with acupuncture, because acupuncture fits into the same category in that the only measured benefit comes from just the non-specific aspects of the ritual of going through the acupuncture. There's no benefit to the acupuncture itself. But there was a very good study in which they had the acupuncturist basically be like just matter-of-fact, no real minimal interaction with the client, just did the acupuncture in and out. And then another one where they maximized the positive interaction and the encouragement and, you know, again, they tried to maximize the touchy-feely aspect of the interaction. And guess which variable made a difference, right? It didn't matter where you stuck the needle. It didn't matter what you did with the needles. The only thing that correlated with the size of the perceived benefit was whether or not the practitioner had a deliberately positive interaction with the client versus a neutral interaction. That's the only thing that mattered. Basically, it's placebo medicine. That's what it is.
That's what's going on here.
Yeah. Well, let's go on to Who's That Noisy, Evan?
Yeah, let me cue that up for everyone. And here we go.
Some kind of animal.
Yeah, I got more emails correcting me about the fact that those were not crickets, that those were actually a species of frog.
Peep frogs or something?
But do you want to know what? Someone got this exactly correct.
It's not the dying beaver, is it?
Yes, it is. Very good, Rebecca.
I read that. I read the post on the forum.
Yeah, me too. But whoever recorded this damn thing should have put the thing out of its misery. Who the hell would do that?
It's the saddest Who's That Noisy ever. It's
a dying beaver.
I suppose so, in a way.
What do you mean you suppose?
Suppose.
Tell the
listeners. He's out there yelling. I mean, if you knew beaver talk, he's going, kill me.
Kill me.
Kill me. And like people are like, no, let's record it.
Shoot me, like the girl at the end of...
Full Metal Jacket.
Full Metal Jacket, yeah.
So here it is in a nutshell. It's a male beaver that was wounded. It is a sad story, as Rebecca said. Some fish and wildlife personnel used dynamite to blow up a beaver dam and as a management strategy of some kind. The female and her newly born young were killed, and the male of the family survived, although he was wounded. And it's the recording of the beaver swimming around that evening in a distressed state of beaverdom.
That's horrible.
So his family was slaughtered and he was wounded and his home was destroyed.
Evan, I demand that you play something happy right now. Anything.
Well, first, who got that right?
Fan Man from the message boards. Fan Man.
Do it.
He got it exactly right. He knew the
recording.
What that was. It was from Bernie Krause, who records soundscapes. And he records in all kinds of habitats all over the world. This was from Minnesota. We're not sure that he actually recorded this one, but he presented it in one of his shows recently. And apparently Fan Man never misses an episode of that particular show and remembered it specifically and with enough information to answer correctly. So congratulations.
Well done.
Excellent jobs.
And what's your happy sound for this week?
All right, so we do have a happy sound for this week. And it is happy. Well, I think it's funny. Here we go.
And why am I here, you ask? See these little mini volcanoes? They contain a certain primordial ooze that I need for my latest evil device. Behold, the De-Evolutionator!
All right, if somebody doesn't get that, I'm going to scream. So there should be a lot of people getting that one correct. No creatures were harmed in the recording of that Who's That Noisy.
All right.
Thank
good,
you
Evan. You redeemed
good luck,
yourself.
Everyone. Yeah, I guess so. Thank you.
All right. Couple of quick emails. First one comes from Shane Lust from Auckland, New Zealand. Now, first, I have to say that Shane Lust must be his porno name. Right? I mean, come on. Shane Lust. All right.
Maybe
that's a common name in New Zealand. Who knows? Maybe everyone in New Zealand is a porno star. Anyway, Shane writes, subject, Ken Ring's ability to predict the weather purely by the moon. Hi, skeptics. Here in New Zealand, we have a forecaster of weather who uses only the moon to predict weather. He does not believe in chaos in weather and can therefore forecast as far ahead as he likes. He claims an 85% accuracy rate. Seems a lot fishy to me. Is there any good science in solely lunar weather forecasting? Jay, go.
Oh, God. All right. The answer is no. It's total crap. The answer is no. But here's why. First and foremost, there's no mechanism for the moon to actually have a dramatic control over the weather. Like, the moon has some influence on the weather because it influences the ocean, and the ocean has a lot to do with the weather. But the moon itself does not actually control the weather to the level of accuracy that this guy is claiming in any way. There's no plausibility here whatsoever. And the only other thing I want to say about this is the Farmer's Almanac uses a similar formula that this guy does, which is basically a combination of like moon phases, and they use different things. Like, they combine sunspots, moon phases, and other astronomical and atmospheric conditions to come up with their predictions. And some people say that the almanac is 80% accurate. And a study had been done on the almanac, and they said that they were only 2% more accurate than complete random chance, which basically means that they're not accurate at all.
That's even worse than just like shooting from the hip kind of weather prediction, where if you do basic things like if it's raining today, it's probably going to be raining tomorrow, or just going with the odds for the season, you know, like what's common during different times of the year.
Well, and how far out were these predictions? Will he make a week
all year?
At a time?
Yeah, he goes out up to 18 months, I think. I'm not even going to name the guy. I don't want to give him any credence whatsoever. The whole thing is total bunk.
Yeah, I mean, his almanac has been looked at in retrospect and basically found that he fails to predict anything. He claims 85%, but that's by reinterpreting his failed forecasts. He's doing a Nostradamus weather prediction thing.
Well, that's exactly what the almanac does.
Yeah.
The fact is, what they say is so vague. It's vague enough that you could pretty much, you know, conclude a lot of different weather conditions out of it. It doesn't say it's going to be this temperature with exactly this, you know, this type of weather happening, this type of precipitation.
Tomorrow,
and all that.
Some precipitation.
Right.
What is that, dew on the ground in the morning?
So this is, it's astrology. This is astrology with weather. That's what it is. And he says he uses astrological charts as part of his forecasting.
There
That's
you
all
go.
It is. Nonsense.
However, you know, back in October, some geographers and climatologists from Arizona State University and the National Climatic Data Center found that the phases of the moon affected rainfall. So it may, in fact, be possible to figure out rainfall judging by the moon.
But interestingly, I don't think this guy's even doing that.
Oh, yeah, no, I'm pretty sure he's just a kook.
Yeah, this
but
is just
I just thought I would mention
he's
that.
He's using lunar astrology, basically,
yeah.
To predict the weather.
Just thought it was interesting that there are some actual scientists who are looking into how the moon may or may not affect our weather systems. They are not in any way, shape, or form associated with this person.
Yeah. And to clarify, the moon doesn't have a dominant influence on the weather. It may be a factor that you can see in there, but and, you know, it affects tides and things like that. So obviously, you know, there's plausible mechanisms for some effect, but it's not like you can. It determines the weather. Influencing the weather and determining the weather are two different things.
Okay.
Okay. One more quick email. This one comes from Matt Nelson from Utah, and Matt writes, "Hey, skeptics, just a quick question. My wife and I are about to start trying for our first child. She suggested that I lay off the caffeine while we try because caffeine is known to lower a man's sperm count. I did a brief search on the interwebs and found conflicting evidence," in quotes. "Some articles suggested caffeine could actually be a boon to those with lower sperm counts. Some articles pointed to cola drinks, not caffeine specifically, as the culprit. Anyway, I thought I'd turn to you for the definitive answer regarding my little swimmers. Do I really have to choose between Cherry Coke and children?"
That's an interesting way of putting it.
Yeah.
First of all, just change into boxers. I think that's the number one thing, right?
Good alliteration.
Well, there is a little bit of information about sperm count and whether or not the testicles are held too far up against the body. The reason why they hang outside the body is so that they could be a little bit cooler than body temperature. If they were at full body temperature, that's the too hot for optimal sperm production. So they're a couple degrees cooler. And the thinking is that if you spend a lot of time in a hot tub, or if you wear really tight undergarments so that they're pressed up against the body, that could reduce the sperm count.
And so basically 1970s swingers, you've got a problem.
Yeah. If you've got a hot tub and a Speedo, you got a problem. But the effect is actually – there is an effect there from temperature. It's pretty modest, but it's measurable. What do you got? What's your vote on caffeine? What do you guys think?
I think that any time you hear of any kind of drug having any kind of effect on sperm count, it's lowering. So I'm going with that.
Yeah. I'll have to agree with that. Hard to argue.
I'm going
to
say no effect.
Yeah, I'll say no effect.
Is that an option?
I didn't know that was an option.
I didn't either.
Of course it is.
This isn't some logical fallacy where we only have two choices.
Right, yeah, why wouldn't that be an effect?
It's a false dichotomy.
So there's actually not that much published about it, but the largest and what seems to be the most definitive study is a Danish study looking at 2,554 men.
Danish and coffee.
Yep. These are men that delivered a semen sample as part of their fitness examination for military service, and they also filled out a questionnaire, including their caffeine intake. So they had data, sperm counts, and a caffeine questionnaire on 2,554 men. So that's pretty good, but it's still observational and not experimental. So there could be variables that we're not accounting for. But what they found was that for moderate caffeine use, there was no effect, basically. They also found that for a high cola intake and or caffeine over 800 milligrams per day, that it was associated with a reduced sperm concentration and total sperm count.
Aha.
However, the reduction was only statistically significant for the cola.
Aha.
So it may be that it's just an effect of drinking a lot of cola and not the caffeine itself. When you separate out those variables, it seems like it's actually the cola that's having the effect and not the caffeine. Little bit of wishy-washy evidence. They're not really sure what it would be in the cola that would do it. And, of course, it's observational. So it could be that those things, drinking a lot of cola or caffeine, are correlate with other behavior that is having a negative influence. Maybe people who drink cola like to sit in hot tubs. Who knows? The bottom line is there isn't a definitive answer. We just have some observational data which suggests really large amounts, so again, like caffeine greater than 800 milligrams a day, which is a lot, or 14 half-liter bottles a week. I guess that's 2 half-liter bottles a day or a liter a day of cola.
That's a lot of
liter,
thanks a day? For breaking that down, Steve.
Well, you know, if I don't do that, we'll get emails saying, why didn't you just say a liter a day? I'm reading it off the study. I don't know why they wrote it that way, but averaged out over a week, it comes out to about a liter a day of Coke, of cola, of whatever brand.
So basically everything in moderation, Don.
Yeah, that's always the good answer to go with. If you just, that's a good default answer whenever these kind of questions come up, and that seems to be the case here. So if you want to have your cup of coffee a day or your cherry Coke, go right ahead.
But maybe God doesn't want you to have a baby. Just keep that in mind.
that aspartame, that'll kill you dead.
That'll get me started. All right, let's go on with our interview. We are being joined now by DJ Grothy. DJ, welcome back to The Skeptic's Guide.
Well, thanks, Steve. Good to be back on the show. Love this show.
And, of course, for those who may not know, DJ Grothy is the current president of the James Randi Educational Foundation and has been doing a wonderful job running that organization for – it's over a year now, right?
Or was it? Yeah, I accepted the position end of 2009, November, around there. So it's – or I guess middle of October. So just slightly over a year, yeah.
And you're primarily here with us tonight to tell us about the Season of Reason. Tell us about that.
Well, the Season of Reason, it's the JREF's annual fundraising campaign, and we started it last year as a little educational nonprofit. Of course, the goal of the JREF is to advance its mission but to promote critical thinking out there, but we can't do it without the support of donors. We're not government-funded. We're not funded by corporations. So last year, we started this fundraising campaign, and this is the second incarnation of it, as it were.
I like the the little ornament.
You mean the Surly Ramix ornament?
Is that what that is?
Ooh.
Awesome.
That's
right.
That's very cool.
Created by Amy.
Good job, Amy.
We are really lucky to have her in the mix with that, and I'll make sure, you know, we just announced it, the Season of Reason, but I'll make sure we get some ornaments to you guys so you could see this really cool thing. Imagine Randy, instead of Santa Claus, being pulled in a JREF sleigh, being pulled by a flying Pegasus with a red glowing nose. You know, it's just a fun idea, and Randy was very pleased with it. So contributors to the Season of Reason campaign, our gift to them for getting involved is this kind of skeptical holiday ornament.
Yeah, it looks really cool.
Now, will they also be doing, you know, Hanukkah and Kwanzaa ornaments of some sort?
Let's not get crazy.
You noticed I said holiday ornament and not Christmas tree ornament. So if I know my skeptic Jews, there will be some of these ornaments hanging on there. On their menorahs, right?
Okay.
And you can use it to festoon your Festivus ornament of choice, whatever that is.
That's true, your pole.
Yeah. Exactly.
Now, Randy sent out an email today, and also there's something about a matching donation if you donate during this time.
For the first time in years and years at the foundation, we're gratified that this year an anonymous donor has stepped up to say we really like the new direction of the JREF. Any donor who contributes during the Season of Reason campaign, I'll match his gift. So that means anyone who supports the JREF over the next couple months will effectively have his or her gift doubled in advance of the JREF's mission.
Up to what, $5, $10?
up to $100,000 this matching gift.
Oh, wow.
Yeah. Wow. That's quite a goal.
Quite significant. So if we're able to generate and kind of inspire the commitment of skeptics everywhere to support the JREF's important mission to the tune of about $100,000, that means an extra $100,000 will go to support that mission.
So where exactly will the money be going?
Well, you know, nonprofits, kind of by definition, are not about profit to shareholders. They're about units of mission. And when I came aboard the JREF, one of the most important things we thought about for the future of the JREF was really helping shore up its educational foundation, bona fides. So there are a number of new programs, educational programs, to advance skepticism in the educational arena. This year we announced grants for educators who bring critical thinking into their classroom to kind of pilot programs. We're making available critical thinking modules for the classroom. We announced one of those using the investigation of ESP for high school students, kind of attached to the National Science Content Standards, also AAAS Science Literary Benchmarks, and using the investigation of the paranormal to really advance understanding of the methods and the content of science. That's one example. We also make available about $10,000 a year in scholarships. We're really excited about entering the digital publishing arena. Books by Randy and others made available on the iPad and Kindle to get this kind of notion, the skeptical inquiry, out to new audiences, not just people who stand up and self-identify as skeptics, but people who might be interested in these sorts of topics but might not be aware of the organizations. And I'm really excited about, imagine skepticism smartphone apps, right? So I'm talking to you right now on an iPhone, the only religion to which I'm still converted, right? Apple. And these little handheld computers are amazing. They have so much kind of processing power. Well, imagine a suite of apps that literally help someone engage in hands-on skepticism. So using the accelerometer in the iPhone, trying out dowsing with education about the ideomotor effect, a Ouija board, or an app about astrology, an app about testing your psychic powers that's connected online to the $1 Million Challenge. So if someone downloads the app and discovers he or she has ESP, well, then try out for the $1 million. So a whole suite of educational iPhone and Android apps that let people explore these sorts of topics in an unbiased way, so it's not kind of hectoring them for what they might believe that we as skeptics might not, but it's a fair, kind of even-handed approach to these sorts of claims that then allows them to get more information through the educational resources that the JREF provides.
How is the podcast For Good Reason going? You took a bit of a hiatus, but you're starting to come back?
Yeah, I think we're slowly but surely kind of getting back in the saddle. Thomas Donnelly, my partner, who's in law school right now, he does all the heavy lifting with the show. I have an interesting conversation with a person once a week. He does all the audio engineering and all that jazz. Well, he's also in law school, and he's in his last semester, and add to that the fact that we just moved to Los Angeles. So we took a short break. But we're sitting on 12 or 13 interviews we've done, and we expect those will be out in short order. In other words, rather than just one per week, we're going to kind of just get them all out in short order.
So you'll upload all 13 within 1 week?
Or over a few weeks, yeah.
Over a few weeks, like okay. That. Great. Well, is there anything else new with the JREF, DJ?
Well, we've been talking about these educational programs that we've launched, JREF in the classroom, the digital publishing, the smartphone apps, the scholarships, the grants for educators. That sounds like a lot of activity. It's really just activity in one department. That's the education department that we created due to the success of last year's Season of Reason campaign. So last year we launched a Season of Reason campaign. People came forward and said, I support the JREF's mission. Here's my couple of bucks. And with that, we hired a director of education programs, Michael Blandford, who has years of experience in the public science education community at a science center. So informal science education. He's spearheading a number of these programs I just mentioned, but we're also revving things up in the outreach area, so more resources for local skeptics groups. We've launched a regional skeptics workshop program where the JREF sponsors with the local organization, local skeptics outfit, a day-long workshop on dowsing or junior skepticism or ESP and cold reading or, you know, one or another topic in skepticism. The one other thing I should mention, Steve, and I know you guys are excited about this too, we were talking before the show, is the proliferation of amazing meetings around the world. I just came back last month from TAM London, and a truly amazing event. That's not just cheeky PR. It was an amazing event. About 1,000 folks showed up in London. A good third of them raised their hands when I asked from the podium, how many of you is this your very first skepticism event? So these amazing meetings are, in fact, outreach events. They're not just preaching to the choir. They're not just ways for us to rally the troops and, give ourselves rah-rah messages, but it's a way to reach new publics with this critical thinking message. Critical thinking benefits us if, for no other reason, skepticism is a kind of intellectual self-defense. We get more out of life when we're not unduly credulous, and these big events that we put on in Vegas for many years, in London for a couple years, and you guys are off to Australia shortly.
Right.
For TAM Australia. It really shows that people are more interested in this kind of message than I've experienced them being in the 12 years I've been at this skepticism racket. So people are excited to get involved, and I guess that's a development worth mentioning.
DJ, though, I have to take exception, though, with one thing, and correct me if I'm wrong, but, you know, when you say that these larger events are outreach, I think they're a great success, and I was at TAM London, and really looking forward to TAM Australia. I think they're wonderful events. But when it comes to spending hundreds of pounds or dollars on a skeptics conference, you can pretty much be assured that most of the attendees are going to be skeptics. Don't you think that the actual outreach part would happen more for the free fringe events and skeptics in the pub and the slightly more accessible events that happen around these conferences?
Accuse me of being a little philosophical on this because I'm going to answer like philosophers do, yes and no. So yes, outreach happens at the fringe events and skeptics in the pub gatherings. Just like that kind of outreach happens all over North America at these events happening week in, week out. But there's outreach and then there's outreach. So just because people pay a couple $100 to go to an event, it doesn't somehow change the definition of those new folks coming into the fold just because they pay an admission fee to a conference. It doesn't somehow change the definition of outreach and turn that into something else. It's still a way to reach new people, as is evinced by all the new folks going to these amazing meetings. Last year in Vegas, we had over 1,300 people, a 30% increase over the year before. That's a kind of outreach when a large minority of these folks say, this is the first skeptical event I've ever come to. Out of TAM London, for instance, so many, I think the number is now 8 or 9 new local groups started up because of TAM London. People getting together, networking, being inspired by the, can I say, the good news of skepticism, right? Going back to their neck of the woods and starting up a pub group. So I consider that outreach. Now, I agree that there are other forms of outreach. You mentioned pub gatherings as a kind of outreach. Well, there are many publics the JREF wants to reach out to. So not just skeptics, even if it's a pub gathering or a big meeting, but believers of all stripes. One program that is in the very kind of early stages of development, very inchoate at this point, not a lot of fruit on the trees or meat on the bones, is outreach into the business world. No skeptics organization has done kind of corporate outreach, corporate skeptics outreach. So all of these audiences merit outreach. I think, not to sound vulgar about it, but the priority initially, as the worldwide skeptics movement gets more organized, should be the low-hanging fruit of people who already think of themselves as skeptic, who could kind of be enlisted in advancing this point of view. Does that even a little answer your question, Rebecca?
That answered 10 questions I didn't even ask.
You're sounding so much like Thomas now. Yeah.
I agree. I mean, what I would say is that, you know, it's not as if you're all the way in or you're all the way out of the skeptical movement. You know, there's two kinds of outreach, you know, broad brushstroke. They're trying to reach people who don't even know we exist and what skepticism is and maybe only have a very peripheral interest in science. You know, people who totally on the outside. But then there's also people who are maybe peripherally aware or interested in the kinds of things that we do, but aren't aware of organized skepticism or maybe are vaguely aware of us, but aren't really fully on the inside. They don't have the fire in the belly, you know? And getting those people all the way in are still outreach.
That's my point, really, is this idea that I hear a lot of people say that we shouldn't be preaching to the choir, or speaking of preaching to the choir in a bad sense. And DJ, you mentioned, you know, it's not all preaching to the choir. But the thing is, I think things like TAM, like these larger events, really are preaching to the choir. But I think that that's really necessary because, you said, it gets them inspired and ends up branching out, and we end up with these people starting smaller skeptical organizations around the country just because they were inspired at TAM. And then I think that when it comes to what I call outreach is actually reaching out to the people who aren't so bought into the whole community that, you know, they're not willing to spend a couple of £100 on it yet. That's what I feel is to me, true outreach, and that's where I think that happens. I think that TAM is an integral part of that, but I think that what it really is in fact, preaching to the choir, getting them fired up, and I think that that's a good thing.
Well, as I rejoined it in a long-winded, fun fashion earlier, I think there's outreach and then outreach. There are new people who come to TAM. I consider that a kind of outreach. But sometimes it's not even outreach that we should be concentrating on in your pure sense of it. So you used a phrase like pure outreach. Well, I think there are all kinds of outreach to multiple publics. And I'll say just one more thing, because I'd be scolded if I didn't. We talk about kind of the price tag of these amazing readings, which I think are among the most expensive in the skeptics movement. They're actually the cheapest in this kind of cottage industry of conferences, right? So TED is multiple thousands of dollars to go to. A lot of these regional events are, you know, $1,000 to go to, weekend long events. I go to a lot of these conferences as a kind of, can I say, outreach as president of the James Randi Educational Foundation, and relative to non-skeptic conferences, amazing meetings are incredibly affordable and reasonable. They might not be cheap when you compare them to a free event at a local pub, but that's why we're, in a sense, talking apples and oranges. I don't think these kinds of events compete. I think they really support and
I would never suggest that they compete. No, I'm totally in agreement with you. I think that TAM is a great value for those people who, you know, have been reading Michael Shermer and, you know, seeing Neil deGrasse Tyson on TV. And I mean, there's just so many wonderful people there. Yeah, there's so many great people there to meet. I mean, it's a great value for the money, definitely.
Well, and on that point, I think I mentioned this to Steve before, or maybe others of you. One of the biggest draws at the Amazing Meeting year after year, more people come to the Amazing Meeting in Vegas because they're listeners to Skeptics Guide. And you guys talk up this cool event that JREF puts on in Vegas, and people come out for it. I think, I know of a couple folks who are going from the States all the way to Australia because you guys are being featured at the Amazing Meeting in Australia.
Hey, DJ, what is it that you think all the skeptics out there are upset about when everyone's saying, you know, we're not doing it right, we're not doing enough grassroots skepticism, and you guys were discussing outreach, and everybody has a different opinion. I mean, what do you think, if any, is the formula to get more people interested in the cause and actually advance the cause?
Well, perfect hot seat question, just like we rehearsed. Thanks. I think, controversially, look, I've had this conversation with a bunch of skeptic activists, people who labor away as volunteers running their local groups. I think the goal of these local groups, we shouldn't kid ourselves. They are not professional science education organizations. A local skeptics group does not and should not be expected to teach the public science or critical thinking. We don't offer courses in science. We're not scientists and professors and, people schooled in pedagogy. Not all of us. Steve, of course, is, and there are a number in our midst who have that background. But most local skeptics groups, yes, they do a kind of outreach, but what they also are, and we should be unapologetic about this, for gosh sakes, they are clubs for people of like mind. They are groups where skeptics can get together and love on one another and enjoy each other's company and have fun over a pint or ten. So I think we should leave it to professional science education organizations to do the heavy lifting when it comes to public education, and these groups should be supportive of those ends. In other words, these organizations should be science boosters, and as they grow and mature, and maybe some of them, you know, achieve nonprofit status, have membership programs, can hire folks, or have experts who will volunteer, they can do more heavy lifting, like the New England Skeptical Society does, like NCAS in D.C., like Bay Area Skeptics in the San Francisco Bay Area has done. A number of other groups do as well.
Well, DJ, it was awesome having you back on the Skeptics Guide. And one more time, the Season of Reason is an opportunity to donate to the JREF. So go out there and do that. Go to the JREF webpage and do what you can to support the skeptical movement, fulfilling the mission of organized skepticism. And hey, you know, feel free to donate to the SGE while you're at it. Thanks again for joining us, DJ.
Yeah.
Hey, thanks, guys. Much appreciated. Talk
thanks,
to you soon.
DJ.
Take we'll care. We'll miss you in Australia, brother.
Yeah, don't rub it in. Like I said, that's a hoot of a party, and I am killing myself that I just cannot go. Have fun, guys.
Take good care. Night.
It's time for Science or Fiction.
Each week I come up with three science news items or facts, two real and one fake, and then I challenge my panel of skeptics to tell me which one is the fake. Is everyone ready for this week?
Let's do it.
Yes.
Okay, here we go.
Bring it.
Item number one, a new study finds that high-intensity narrow-spectrum light is effective in treating bacterial infections, even in some deep tissues. Item number two, the remains of Tycho Brahe were recently exhumed in order to obtain evidence as to the cause of his death, specifically that he may have been poisoned, with one of the suspects being Johann Kepler. Item number three, new consumer research finds that consumers may prefer a credit card with a 1% interest over a 0% interest rate because the number zero can cause confusion.
Oh, that makes me fear for humanity.
Evan, go first.
People are confused over the number zero?
It means zero.
No. I can imagine at the time that the concept of zero was being discussed amongst intellectuals and mathematicians, what, many, many millennia ago, that it was interesting, you know, that it could cause confusion. But today, that's interesting. I think that's so ridiculous that I think it's true. And that means I have to go with one of the other ones. The new study finds that high-intensity, narrow-spectrum light effective in treating bacterial infections, even in some deep tissues. And this is interesting coming on the heels of this of our discussion last week about how light can't penetrate the skull to affect the brain. But there are, in a follow-up, in further discussions and message postings and emails and so forth, we were talking about I think, what was it, Steve? The visible light spectrum, not the really high intensity.
Near infrared.
Yeah, which could. So I have a feeling that this one is going to be correct based on what I've learned over the last week and what I've read from the posts and everything. Therefore, the remains of Tycho Brahe, I think they were recently exhumed, but I don't think Kepler was one of the suspects. Although he could have been. He was around when he died. But I'm going to say that one's fiction.
Okay, Jay.
Okay, so the first one, the study about the high intensity narrow spectrum light as a effective antibacterial. I totally agree with that. There's no reason to not believe that. The remains of Tycho Brahe and the cause of his death. So, Steve, can you say what they thought that Kepler poisoned him?
That's what it says.
Do they know? Can you tell us what the poison was?
Does it matter?
Well, maybe a little bit. I mean,
well, that's one of the things they're trying to find out.
Okay. And I mean, but what would be if this one's false? What would it? What would the false version of it be? That the guy didn't poison him? I guess so.
They didn't exhume him. He wasn't disinterred. I don't know.
Okay. And this final one here, the new consumer research finds that consumers may prefer a credit card with the 1% interest over zero. All right. I mean, after thinking about this, maybe they think, you know, we all know that the 0% thing is always temporary, right? It's usually, you know, a year or 18 months or whatever. But maybe they think that the 1% it would last is like permanent. I don't know. I mean, I find the 1% a little more confusing, if anything, than the 0%, because you can damn count on the 0% not lasting forever. Are there people out there that really can't interpret the 0% meaning no interest? Wow, that's sad. I'm going to say that because I do believe in immense human stupidity, that last item, it could definitely be true, and I just don't know anything about the exhumed Tycho Brahe, so I'm going to say that's the fake.
Okay, Bob.
Let's start with three. Consumers. Yeah, I mean, never, you know, expecting consumers to be rational, I mean, that would be irrational. So, yeah, that makes total sense to me. I mean, I could totally buy that. Tycho Brahe, interesting. Kepler, often Tycho. Wow, that's pretty interesting. Yeah, what the hell? I mean, I really don't have a problem with it. I guess Kepler probably had a lot of reasons to be pissed at him. But so, yeah, I'm buying that one. I'm having a little trouble with the first one here, the high-intensity light treating bacterial infections. Yeah, I mean, I could see the high-intensity narrow-spectrum light effective for surfaces, but deep tissues, that's like probably literally just too good to be true. I'm not buying it that it's going to get into deep tissues, although that would be amazing. But I'm just not buying it, so I'm going to say that one's fiction.
Okay, Rebecca?
Oh, man. Okay, I'm going to start by talking about Tycho Brahe, because he's only the greatest scientist who ever lived. For those of you who don't know, he lost his nose in a duel and replaced it with a gold one. He had a midget and an elk at his giant palace that he used to entertain people. And
did you say phallus or palace?
Palace. I don't think he actually had a palace, actually, I should say.
He has a golden palace?
He had like a...
Wow.
He had a busted palace over his chamber door?
He probably did.
He did what with an elk?
Nevermore.
And I should mention,
had a gold nose and a midget, how badass would I be? That would be,
you'd be
and an elk. And an elk, Jay.
And the elk
sadly died when it got drunk and fell down the stairs. These are facts about Tycho Brahe. Also, when I was in Copenhagen in June, I sought out the Tycho Brahe planetarium. And wouldn't you know that right across the street, a strip club. I bet Tycho would have liked it that way.
I bet you founded it.
It's
the first observation he made with his telescope. Hey, look what's across
exactly.
the street.
Exactly. The telescope is just constantly pointed into the window of the strip club. As legend has it, Tycho Brahe died by...
Bruce Bladder?
Because he was at the dinner table for so long, entertaining a guest, that he felt it rude to leave, and so he died when his bladder exploded.
That's a myth, though, right?
So much.
Is it apocryphal?
But yes, I'm pretty sure that is a myth, and I have heard stories about him being poisoned for a very long time. These have been
really,
I think. Very long time. They've thought that Tycho was poisoned, and I'm pretty sure he's been exhumed in the past because, like, it's Tycho Brahe, and who knows what that crazy mofo was up to. And you know,
Rebecca, if the guy had a gold nose and a midget, there's no way that he would not go take a piss if he had to go.
Well, that's why I'm saying it is apocryphal. I don't think that's true. I think he was poisoned, and I think it was that bastard Johannes Kepler, who I believe was his assistant.
Jay, so, well, real quick, Jay, the midget isn't used anymore. I think it's little person.
It is, in fact, little person now, yes.
Just saying.
No, it's a good point. It's a good point. We have a few little people in our audience, and we don't want to offend them. But he did keep a little person as an entertainment sort of thing. So it's not entirely on the up and up, politically correct. But he was awesome.
Right.
He was, in fact, awesome, though. And the reason why I go into so much detail about Tycho Brahe is, one, because he's awesome, and two, because I know nothing about the other two items. So,
good job. Very entertaining.
So...
if not informative.
A high-intensity, narrow-spectrum treating bacterial infections? Sure, why not? The reason why I'm suspicious of the idea that consumers prefer a credit card with 1% interest over 0% interest is not because I think consumers are necessarily logical or intelligent, but just I have a lot of faith in the marketing industry in general, who have been using 0%, 0%, 0% since the beginning of time to advertise credit cards and whatnot. And I think that they would have discovered earlier that it wasn't working. So I'm going to say that is the false item.
Excellent. So you spread out.
Haven't done that in a while. You're all wrong.
Let's see. Let me start with the Tycho Brahe one. The remains of Tycho Brahe were recently exhumed in order to obtain evidence as to the cause of his death, specifically that he may have been poisoned, with one of the suspects being Johann. Is it Johann or Johannes?
I didn't say Johannes.
I just looked it up and it didn't give me a pronunciation guide. Kepler. That one is science.
Yay. Go Tycho.
Rebecca, you're correct. He was exhumed previously.
I know a lot about Tycho Brahe.
Yeah, he was exhumed in 1901.
Oh, by the guy who discovered King Tut.
They had no technology back then.
A pitchfork.
He tests
a shovel.
Essentially, the thinking is that he might have been poisoned with mercury, and that is something that would still exist in his hair and bones.
Cool.
So they tested for that, and they did have high levels of mercury when he was previously exhumed.
Mm.
However, they want to take fresh samples and use modern techniques to confirm that and see what the accurate real levels were. It's possible that he was taking mercury as a remedy, which was done. Mercury was actually used to fight.
Can I say something else about him?
Yeah.
How kick-ass was he that they exhumed him twice because his life was so interesting?
Yeah.
Well, twice that we know of.
Pull that guy out of the ground
or his
again.
Death.
Parade his corpse in here again. His life was so interesting, we need to examine him just one more time.
Why do they suspect Kepler of being one of the people poisoning him? Just because of their adversarial
relationship?
Because he wasn't
as awesome as Tycho.
Because he had a lot to gain? He had a lot to gain from his death?
Well, he was his apprentice at the time.
Didn't he get all his research and all that stuff?
Eventually, but Tycho held it over his head for a while.
Yeah, Tycho had like this amazing collection of naked eye observations that was like unparalleled. Like, damn.
There's also thinking he was sleeping with the wife of a noble and that he might have been killed for that reason. There are other theories as well.
He did get around.
They're also going to take a piece of his nose prosthesis to see what it was made of because
it could be copper.
That's right.
Pyrite.
There could be
but it's cooler to say gold.
Or solid mercury.
Well, the one hypothesis is that it's gold and gold and silver. But the question is it made of copper? Is there copper? Okay.
Let's hear copper.
Let's go to item number three.
Of course.
New consumer research finds that consumers may prefer a credit card with a 1% interest over a 0% interest rate because the number zero can cause confusion. Rebecca, you think this one is fiction. The rest of you think this one is science. And this one is science.
Bah.
Yeah.
It was
very
a coin flip.
Interesting. Yeah, I mean, your point is well taken, but this is why this is from the Journal of Consumer Research. This is what they do to try to tweak ways of selling us stuff, right, and manipulating consumers. So what they – and I said consumers may prefer – it depends on the scenario. The specific scenario that they were looking at was comparing two cards. So if you compare a 1% interest rate to a 20% interest rate as one comparison, and then in another comparison it was a 0% versus 20%. And what they found was that more people preferred the 1% over the 0% when they were compared in turn to 20%. The thinking there is that mentally we judge things relatively, right? Where we actually, especially when it comes to value, we tend to assess things more in terms of their relative value than their absolute value.
Mm-hmm.
They gave us an example. Your intuitive gut feeling about the difference between $15 and $45 is different than your gut feeling about the difference between $115 and $145, right? It's both the same. It's both $30. But $45 is three times as much as $15, and $145 is not that much more than $115.
Yeah.
So here what's happening is you think, all right, wow, 20%, that's 20 times as much as 1%. That's a huge difference. So we have a gut instinct that a card with a 20% interest rate is a lot worse than a card with a 1% interest rate. That 1% is really low. But you can't make an intuitive comparison between 20% and 0% because there's no ratio. There's no, you know what I mean? So you kind of lose that intuitive feel. You get confused by the 0%, and therefore not as many people chose that as being advantageous because they didn't have that same emotional sort of gut reaction to it as it did with the 1%.
Wow.
Fair enough.
Yeah, so what they say this could mean is that if you are going to go up against a competitor, let's say a competitor is offering something good, like a $20 rebate, you don't want to offer a little amount in comparison, you're better off offering nothing rather than a small amount, right? Because if you say, if you give a $5 rebate as opposed to a $20 rebate, people will emotionally, instinctively understand, oh yeah, 20 is much bigger than 5. But if you just don't give it at all, they won't have necessarily have the same reaction.
It confuses them.
Right? It confuses them. Confused by zero. So I thought that was interesting. Which means a new study finds that high-intensity, narrow-spectrum light is effective in treating bacterial infections even in some deep tissues is fiction. And Bob, you got it exactly right.
Yes.
That this research shows that HINS, or high-intensity, narrow-spectrum light, is effective at killing bacteria on surfaces, but not in actual people causing an infection. And what they're looking to do with this light is environmental decontamination. For example, you can set these up in patients' rooms, and that what they found was that for certain bacteria, it would reduce the number of bacteria on exposed surfaces by as much as 90%, but it depended on the type of bacteria, with some of the more virulent bacteria like methicillin-resistant Staph aureus, or MRSA, reductions were between 56 and 86%.
Wow.
Yes, yeah, so the highest being 86%. So that's pretty good. So that, you know, it doesn't sterilize the surfaces, but it can reduce the number of bacteria. And that matters because that reduces the chance of an infection. And if you do get exposed, it reduces the bacterial load or the amount of the inoculation, which reduces the chance of actual infection. You know, you get exposed to a small number of bacteria and your immune system may be able to overwhelm them before they have a chance to reproduce. The more individual bacteria that you get exposed to at once, the greater the chance of it setting up an infection.
What kind of damage is the light doing specifically?
That's a good question. It causes the creation of a lot of like free radicals, which then destroys the bacteria.
We need antioxidants to deal with them.
Yeah, exactly. They may actually develop a protein that's a powerful antioxidant or something. You know,
cool.
Well, good work. Who got this one right, Bob? I think it was just
GWB. GWB people.
Bob, you can't GWB because you are B.
Jay, give us a quote.
You guys know who Thomas Paine is?
Oh yeah.
Yeah, might have heard of him.
Oh my
once
gosh.
Or twice.
Common sense. Author of Common Sense.
Yeah.
Call him Founding
TP.
Father of our good country.
1776. Former British expatriate. Emigrated to America to start his printing business.
Excellent. Excellent Brilliant. Job, Ever. Did you know he said some things and they happen to have been written down?
Might have heard something about
yes.
that.
Yes.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, Thomas Paine said...
Didn't he have a blog?
No. Thomas Paine said... We have never seen in our time nature go out of her course, but we have good reason to believe that millions of lives have been told in the same time. It is therefore at least millions to one that the reporter of a miracle tells a lie. Thomas Paine!
Yeah, good one, Jay.
Yeah, it's a version of Occam's Razor, I guess.
Common Sense, when it was first printed, 2 million copies. That's the equivalent today of 100 million copies sold.
Wow.
So he was... the J.K. Rowling of the time, except, you know, as far as book sales go. He had more important business, though.
Well, we have no announcements this week because this show is going up and we're all already on the road at our various events, eventually converging on Sydney, Australia. We're looking forward to it. Well, thanks for joining me again this week, everyone.
Ank you, Steve.
Hey,
Shirley.
Steve. See you
thanks,
in Canada.
Steve.
Oh, wait, there you are. Hi.
See you all in Sydney. And until next week, this is your Skeptic's Guide to the Universe. The Skeptic's Guide to the Universe is produced by the New England Skeptical Society in association with the James Randi Educational Foundation and SkeptChick.org. For more information on this and other episodes, please visit our website at www.theskepticsguide.org. For questions, suggestions, and other feedback, please use the Contact Us form on the website or send an email to info@theskepticsguide.org. If you enjoyed this episode, then please help us spread the word by voting for us on Dig or leaving us a review on iTunes. You can find links to these sites and others through our homepage. Theorem is produced by Kinetto and is used with permission.